Isn't that supposed to be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, Summer Falcon's Green, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Sometimes. Hello.
And freelance writing critic Virat Nehru.
Rarely and always.
Later in the program, not never really, sometimes always, but actually later in the program, we're going to be talking about the new Ron Howard film on Netflix, Hillbilly Elegy. It's gotten some press, let's just say.
The highly anticipated by critics, Hillbilly Elegy, and nobody else, I would say.
The extremely loud film of the year in many respects.
Yes.
We're also talking about Happiest Season and touching a bit on the Kino Sydney Cabaret Weekend that was the big Warner Brothers news of the week. And SFF, Sydney Film Festival's announcement about the Wong Kar-wai retrospective. First things first, though, news of the week, the festivals that are happening. The Children's International Film Festival is currently screening at the Ritz and at some Melbourne cinemas for those playing from Melbourne. The Veterans Film Festival is screening online until the end of the month. The Japanese Film Festival Australia is currently screening in and around Sydney. And the Antenna Documentary Film Festival just announced a number of new screenings currently and going into the new year. Now, in terms of festival news, the big news of the week locally is that Sydney Film Festival, in addition to a program running in late January at the State Theatre, have announced a retrospective coming up of director Wong Kar-wai.
I have waited so long for this. I think I was following this news initially when it was announced that Criterion were doing a retrospective of 4K restoration of all his films.
Yeah.
And so it was awaited, I think, earlier this year around May.
By the look of it, it's going to be 4K restorations of his first 7 films. I think maybe more. Oh, his 7 films plus The Hand, the short.
Plus The Hand, yeah.
Previously part of an omnibus, now extended to almost feature length. My Blueberry Nights and will not be restored, and The Grandmaster is sadly, by the look of it, screening in the American cut, which I think is quite severely inferior. Wong Kar-wai says it's just an alternate cut, but it's built around demands from Harvey Weinstein to dumb down the film, essentially. It's a weird shame that as part of a complete retrospective we're seeing that version instead of the one that he labored over for ages.
It's weird because apparently when Criterion were first asked, and they did say that they were restoring the Hong Kong version.
I wonder if there's just some rights problem with the Weinstein Company or whoever manages their library still owning the film in English-speaking markets, making it hard to screen the original version. But hopefully that will eventually sort itself out. I shouldn't focus on this one downside. It's amazing we're going to see his early films.
Yeah, I mean, some of the films, and Chris and I were discussing this previously before the show started.
Yeah, we can always nerd out over Wong Kar-wai.
Yeah, but the fact is, on his popular films, like In the Mood for Love, rightly loved. But some of the films that people might not know about, his earlier films, the works.
Happy Together
we
is
really
our favorite.
Love. Yeah.
Fallen Angels before that is very style over substance, but I think it's really going to sing on the big screen.
Yeah, and Days of Being Wild, which
Days of Being Wild is
tanked at the box office at the time. Nobody seems to really talk about it.
But it's a beautiful. No, I think real Wong heads are into it. Days of Being Wild is great. They're all great. Go to the Wong Kar-wai retrospective. It's in January and February at Art Gallery of New South Wales and Dundee Newtown.
The exact dates. It's in partnership with Acme. It is screening at the Art Gallery from the 16th to the 31st of January and at Dundee Newtown from the 19th to the 18th.
Yeah, got an all-season pass, so I'm going to be there at all 11 of them, which is going to be exciting. But if you still want to watch only 3 or 4 of them, check out. You know, it's just a great thing given what's happening in the world of cinema.
Everything up to 2046 is in a new restoration, so in 4K. It's going to look gorgeous.
Yeah.
Another brief aside in terms of film news. A couple of years ago, we interviewed an Irish director called Trevor Burney, who made a film called No Stone Unturned by Alex Gimney about a massacre in Loughlin Island. We also reported shortly following the Irish Film Festival, which he came out for, that he had been arrested by the local police in connection with the film he made and some of his sources. It's recently been announced that he and his filmmaking partner have settled with the police for several hundred thousand pounds in a settlement. So, yep, bit of an update on that front. I'm sure it will go to funding his next movie.
Yeah.
Yep.
Good for him.
Yep. So just briefly, Kino Sydney. This weekend, Chris and I have discussed being part of the Kino Cabaret. It was Kino 155. It is a short filmmaking collective. People mostly around Sydney, but people from Melbourne come up too. You have 48 hours. You make a film. They screen once a month, and people expect an open mic night for films. But once a year, people get together and have a weekend of filming. Chris and I just did it. It was wonderful. It's worth going on the Kino page, checking out some of the films. Some of the filmmakers and Kino will be posting those regularly. But they're also going to be having events come January and February months. So it's still very worth getting involved. And it's a still extremely vibrant atmosphere.
And it's very good to be around people with a lot of energy coming out of the lockdown hell a lot of us have been in this year.
Yeah, I think like any artist, you have artists who have been itching to do work and have been preparing material. So these all these artists have been able to collaborate coming out of this long haul of not being able to work and not being able to do what they've always wanted to do, and suddenly having the people around them who also want to do the same thing. So a lot of incredible creative juices flowing. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah.
The next thing we want to talk about is Happiest Season. There was a pre-run as part, or sorry, a couple of pre-screenings as part of Queer Screen at the Newtown, the Brisbane Queer Film Festival, the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. It is in cinemas now. It stars Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis, and Virat saw it.
Yes, I was actually looking forward to this because Claire Duvall's previous film, her debut film, The Intervention, was actually quite funny. And I was very surprised at how unfunny Happiest Season turned out to be. I mean, I'm not criticizing the fact that the films, you know, that this is a Christmas film, essentially, but with a twist. You have, you know, a central representation of a queer couple who's basically the center of the narrative. And basically, it's using the same template of a Love Actually-style Christmas-themed narrative to tell, basically, a cheerful Christmas story. So I'm not essentially against that.
I hate cheer and Christmas.
It's exactly that.
There are many Christmas movies on Netflix right now. You can go watch it. Oh, dear. So many.
Yeah, but are there any queer ones?
Not to my knowledge.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, so that's the thing. I mean, there is a bigger debate around representation and the fact that just because we do not have a queer Christmas film, is that enough to make an unfunny Christmas film just because it's queer with queer characters? I mean, that's a bigger debate that we should have, or should we actually try to make a funny film while we're at it?
I think obviously we should try to make a funny film while you're at it, but what you're touching on has been kind of my axe to grind with critics lately, that I feel like a lot of films are getting rewarded for having good intentions. And because critics feel like they need to do their bit to encourage more of this, you know, positive representation or something for underrepresented groups, or a positive feminist message or what have you, but they're ignoring the nuts and bolts of filmmaking and whether it actually has much worth as a piece of art in terms of, you know, engaging the mind or emotions.
If there's something that's come up on the show previously, I won't talk to any particular film in this example, but to say I think that filmmakers deserve credit when they pursue a novel premise or novel casting or a novel theme.
Sure.
Having said that, if it's not pursued well, it also deserves to be called out like any other film.
Sure.
I mean, in brief, I mean, just what the film is about, you have the central couple with Abby and Harper, played by Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis, respectively. And you have the central couple going to Harper's family, which is a very, you know, you can say a conservative family where the dad is running for mayor. It's a very politically charged. And
so
you find
the
out. Yeah, essentially. And so you see all these Christmas narratives.
Sorry, the Kajapol, excuse me.
Yeah. You have all these Christmas narratives coming home to roost, pardon the pun. But essentially, you realize, and suddenly you find out the twist is that Harper hasn't come out to...
This is an early twist, to be clear.
Yes, it's very early twist.
Okay, this is the setup. Okay, fine.
The setup is that Harper hasn't come out to her family. So you have the entire film, or the laughs are played for the fact that a couple has to hide their identity and basically hide in the closet, quite literally.
Isn't it
while they're in the closet as well, from the family.
Isn't it interesting that these kind of crossover to mainstream queer stories, like the early signs of we're getting formula rom-coms but with queer characters, like Love, Simon and now this, are framed around coming out narratives? Like,
yeah.
It's so the stock standard narrative. Like, I wonder when we're going to progress to a point where in mainstream representations it's not a big deal.
Yeah, but also the fact is...
I'm not trying to downplay people's experience with difficulty coming out and such.
Like in Freaky last week,
not wanting to
actually handled, which was handled quite well.
Right, it was.
Yeah. But what really sort of girdled my goat, I don't know, is that an expression people use anymore?
It is now.
Yeah, what really girdled my goat was the fact that essentially you have Abby's character, Kristen Stewart, who's playing a very grumpy, Grinch, I hate Christmas kind of, you know, character, which we've seen in basically all stereotypical heteronormative templates of Christmas anyway. And so it is reinforcing that idea that Christmas is for, and you have everyone else who's basically passive-aggressive throughout the movie. And they can be broad-brush stereotypes as people who are, you know, making fun of people who are you know, queer or different, but are playing up that Christmas spirit to indicate how accepting and actually, you know, progressive they are, a.k.a. the Get Out template. I would have voted for Obama if I could have.
Right,
so
right.
We've seen this play out in other films. And now, because of that, this feels like I've seen this and done that kind of, you know, feeling all over again. This is so on the nose and it's not funny at all. What is funny, however, and quite touching, are some of the cameo appearances by Aubrey Plaza and Dan Levy and Alison Brie. So the supporting cast actually is
They're actually cameos? It looked like from the marketing they were major figures in the film.
I would say they're extended cameos, given how much screen time is spent on Abby and Harper's relationship, and they are basically carrying most of the film. They're extended cameos. They're quite a breath of fresh air because they essentially are not playing to type, which helps to really bring some freshness to the film. But otherwise, this is a film which I was very confused why it exists, apart from the fact that, hey, let's make a queer Christmas movie.
All right. Thank you for asking.
There's some money in that.
There is, yeah. I'm not saying there's not a market for it, but I'm still confused why, as a film, it needs to be made. Yeah.
Why this one? Surely there's some better examples of queer holiday scripts that haven't been gotten the green light.
Or have otherwise been made but only screened on the independent circuit.
Right.
And are now, 10, 15 years old, maybe more.
Hmm. Yeah.
So that is Happiest Season. It is in cinemas now. Before we get on to Hubilee Elegy, and you're listening to Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Bharat Nehru on Film Fight Club, is we want to talk briefly about the really big film news of the week, is that Warner Brothers have announced that for the next year, beginning in Christmas, including Wonder Woman 84, that their slate of films will be released simultaneously on home release, on streaming, HBO Max in the US, and in cinemas. This is a big deal. Disney certainly made an announcement they were pivoting to streaming.
Yeah.
But for Warner Brothers to make this move, they've come more hot out of the gate than any of the other major studios.
Yeah. We're going to hear more specifics from Disney about what their plan is, but they've implied in the past that they'll do something similar to what Warner Brothers have announced. It seems to be the way that most of the big studios are going. That said, I feel like this announcement was probably very rushed, and I think Warner Brothers are really unsure about it, because we were hearing reports over the whole year about the disputes over how to deal with Tenet and Wonder Woman 84. They really resisted putting Wonder Woman on a streaming service for as long as they could, essentially. They've decided Christmas is the cutoff, it seems. They have to get it out this year. But immediately after making this announcement, Legendary, because they financed 75% of Dune and King Kong versus Godzilla.
That's Legendary Pictures, by the way.
That's right.
For
yes.
People who are listening.
Yes, right. Thank you, Rod, to be clear. Yes.
Big, now Chinese-owned Hollywood production funding. It often funds big blockbuster films. They've stepped in and said, hang on, we paid for 75% of the budget of these films. You can't just put it on streaming and cut us out of the equation. So some of this may not come to pass. What Warner Brothers have announced is that every one of their films will go to streaming. But clearly, if there was no contact with Legendary, this is a very rushed announcement. And the fact that it's only for 1 year tells me that they're hedging their bets.
They're saying it's for 1 year. Certainly, they have the discretion to extend it. I'm waiting to see how this plays out. Certainly, from a broader macro perspective, I'm all fine with people having access to films and people being able to see this where they are, where they're comfortable being.
It will kill cinemas to a big extent if everyone does this, I think, though.
For me, it's not just the major worry of how cinemas will survive. We discussed previously. Certainly, my view is that cinemas will be very much around, but in the lesser form. Certainly, the independent art house cinemas. I think festivals may very well thrive in this environment. But I think what we're going to see, and it's fine with something like Wonder Woman and the big budget films that have been made, but if any major studio knows that their bread and butter is going to be people watching stuff on phones or at home, then a lot of the emphasis on cinema, big screen cinema adventure, is going to be withdrawn. Now, I'm not talking about the big Marvel Cinematic Universe style films. I'm talking about the technical side of things, the effects, the sound design. There's going to be less emphasis on intricate visual effects, visual storytelling, but also sound, which is so essential. So a lot of technicians, a lot of artists in this field are very concerned right now as to what this could mean, and that they will have forums to tell their stories. Maybe a lot of the studios will still place the same emphasis on what will be streaming as what would otherwise be in cinemas. Surely there will be cinemas and films that will be made for the cinema directly, but there will be a lesser demand among studios for this higher technical level of filmmaking.
And cinema really takes sound to another level. I mean, I just have to mention David Lynch. I just saw Inland Empire in a theater on Thursday, right? The sound work in that, like, in that, that cinema boxes, is incredible, you know? But putting aside that film, it just shows, like, the power of, you know, what you see something at home and then you see it in a theater and it's a completely different experience in terms of what sound does and just having a visceral reaction.
Yeah,
you know, like shaking you with bass.
Nick Cage's performance.
Showing subtleties.
Nick Cage's performance in that film.
Mandy.
Sorry.
Mandy has amazing sound as well, though.
That's true.
It does. Yeah. And you know what? People criticize Tenet for the sound, but I enjoyed just the shock of it. The physical shock. We have to remember there is something physical to how sound is portrayed in cinema, which I can't afford a beautiful home entertainment system like some do, and it's even close akin to cinemas.
Right.
And people...
That's what I meant to bring up with the Inland Empire example. Yeah. It had a physical shock that I felt the rumbling bass throughout.
Think back to the opening sequence in Tenet, right? I mean... that really does sort of jolt you into your seat and you kind of like thrown in the thick of the action. And a lot of that is to do with how the sound really kicks in, which is hard to do on your mobile phone speakers.
People have neighbors, you know, you can't really. Yeah. So maybe when headphones is one thing, but being in a space, feeling the vibrations in the space around you and having other people experience it is so powerful.
Everyone can soundproof every room.
Right, exactly. One last thing about this, because I found it too funny not to mention. Christopher Nolan, who notably was reported, as I touched on earlier, to have been feuding with Warner Brothers over when to release Tenet and basically pushing them to release it in cinemas before Warner Brothers executives were comfortable with releasing the film. He was really pushing for it, so it shows how much sway he has with the company and how much the company is willing to bend to his will and potentially lose tons of money just based on not alienating him. He made the most bitchy kind of comment about this in the paper Variety, I think it was.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was Variety.
Where he said a bunch of filmmakers have woken up this morning thinking that their films were going to be seen in amazing theaters and to learn that they're being screened on the worst screening platform. Yeah. How do you think Warner Brothers are going to feel about this guy publicly trashing their big push at the moment? And are they going to give this guy such big breaks in the future?
No.
Yeah.
No, they won't.
It seemed like a crazy bridge-burning moment. Like, this guy thinks he can get away with anything to
me. But it was look, we have stuck our neck out for you.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with Nolan, but there's a professionalism.
Exactly. They really stuck their head out for him, and he's giving a pull quote to everybody trying to take down their biggest... For what they're saying is their future... priority
and
as a business
venture. I appreciate he thinks there's a purism to it. This is certainly the sort of thing we might have seen from many other directors. But you know what? It's just...
He could have said it in a less...
He could have said it privately and had a big impact.
That's right.
But honestly...
Yeah. Talk to the right people behind the scenes.
Maybe he did. We don't know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's kind of the thing. I mean, if you look at or hear from all the directors' roundtables that have been happening with The Hollywood Reporter... the major concern for a lot of these directors, especially from that era, has been the fact that they're very concerned about the future of cinema and what the studio system is going to do to it.
Yeah.
Even Fincher and Mank, I mean, what we were discussing just last week, that is coming out of that apprehension, and quite literally from that sense. So I feel like if Nolan is voicing these concerns publicly, I think he's already tried the private route, and now he's just like, it's falling on deaf ears, so I'm just going to go all Hail Mary
That doesn't mean I agree, but he must be very angry, very desperate,
and
thinks he's representing a lot of filmmakers who wouldn't otherwise have their voices heard.
Yeah,
yeah.
And the thing is, I feel like a lot of artists in the industry would appreciate someone like Nolan giving them that brand recognition. If like Nolan is saying it, then suddenly,
well, maybe very soon some of those other guys will get a big shot when Warner Brothers needs a new big filmmaker to champion.
So
he might not trash HBO Max so loudly.
So speaking of, you're listening to Film Faculty, Glenn Fountain, and Chris Evans of Brightly Roo. Speaking of big studios and big studio filmmakers,
and streaming,
Yeah, Hillbilly Elegy is the new big film on Netflix of the week. It is from director Ron Howard, and it is based on the biopic. Memoir of J.D. Vance, successful.
It's based on many biopics that have been made before.
Yeah, successful venture capitalist who grew up in the Appalachian Mountains in Ohio. It is starring Glenn Close, Amy Adams, Hayley Bennett, Frida Pinto, and Gabrielle Basso and Owen Astalas, respectively, as the young and old J.D. Vance. It is about, told in flashback, about his experience at Yale Law School and also his early life living in the Appalachian Mountains. Now,
yeah, it feels like a Netflix movie. To get it out of the way, no matter what Hollywood stars you put into it, these films always feel just like a little bit underdeveloped.
It feels like a Netflix film from a long time. It feels like a TV movie. Now, look, this is a couple things. This has been trashed incessantly. Every year, there's always a film that critics hold out for. That, okay, we can have a go at this. And certainly we've seen this. Though, unlike Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close and a few others, it's notable that the nature of the criticism hasn't been too, while it's been scathing, it hasn't been sarcastic. I think there's a real reckoning with just how, I think Insidious is too strong, but how damaging aspects of this film could be, mm-hmm. and how I think how problematic is from so many broad perspectives, and how what it represents that we'll get into a little bit. But from a filming perspective, a lot of people criticized varied aspects from Howard's direction. The thing I want to focus on is something I actually haven't really seen talked about. It's that, and this is such a base thing to say, but we have to say it. A film is not a set of scenes. It is a collection of scenes creating a whole. Ron Howard is a filmmaker who tells serialized, chapter-esque films.
Which is a valid approach, but here it doesn't work.
No, we saw it in Solo. Here, every scene stands in stark contrast. Every star scene resets the tone. So the good scenes, by my count, four, which I'm happy to say do have good aspects, stand in such stark contrast to the overwhelmingly bad scenes that otherwise litter the film.
On that note, I just found that it didn't have much momentum. I'm okay with it being told in vignettes, but there wasn't much of a cohesive through line in terms of what this all adds up to and what story it's telling. And because it's so stop-start in terms of here's this big loud thing happening and there's another loud thing happening, it's not very well modulated.
The entire film is loud.
Yeah, so there isn't much emotional momentum or intellectual continuity. It just feels like random snatches of Oscar clips.
I mean, it just feels like a play that's been cinematically adapted, essentially.
Play would have more literary cohesiveness.
But I was thinking of that Denzel Washington film called Fences, and that's probably a very direct comparison from this one. Now, I liked that film.
Similar subject call that matter, a film, but a very different approach.
From that sense, because at least it was not trying to... I liked it in the sense that the play and the staging of it, I mean, I don't know, Aaron Glenn disagrees very much so. It was not trying to be cinematic, whereas I think in this one, in trying to be cinematic, whereas still failing comprehensively, both as a play that is cinematically staged and also as a piece of cinema, I think this film failed on both accounts. It was even less engaging for me.
The only analogy I would make with the play is the performances. Now, if Amy Adams and Glenn Close were doing those performances in the Queen's Theatre on Shaftesbury Avenue, and
they're playing to the back rows.
They're playing to the back rows. It's the same, the Fences analogy, the scenes with Denzel Washington just screaming at the camera, shouting very loudly. It's the same with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick in the producer's film. They are at a heightened level. The performances aren't bad. They're just for a different medium. Yeah. And the problem is it draws attention to the fact that the other actors in this film, including the two actors who are cast as Vance, aren't especially good.
That's true. But Hayley Bennett was very good.
Hayley Bennett was good, but she was barely in it.
She was barely in it. But perhaps the reason she seems so good in comparison is because there's some subtlety and restraint, because she doesn't need to be winning an Oscar with every scene. Going back to
To be clear, Amy Adams and Glenn Close are both going for Oscars.
Right. And I was saying earlier on about how because it's always so loud emotionally, things don't really register much as in terms of having a cohesive through line through the film. And that's also true of the performances. Because despite how hard they're trying, it didn't to me feel that Amy Adams or Glenn Close were particularly good. They're affecting in moments. But firstly, the material lets them down. I always struggle to think a performance is good when it's badly written, honestly. But it can sometimes a performance can transcend the writing. But it doesn't here because with such little modulation, there's no subtlety to the performances. There's no contrasts to make the big moments feel affecting. No. Instead, it's just kind of like a mess of the particularly mannered way that they've chosen to portray Appalachian stereotypes, just coming at you full force, loudly. As Glenn said last night, this is a very loud film when we were chatting about it.
Also, just as an aside, what was Frida Pinto doing in this movie? I mean, after Slumdog Millionaire.
She's just the love interest.
Thankless I know, but role. Just after Slumdog Millionaire, I mean, where has her career trajectory gone? I mean, I just feel so sad. I mean, she should fire her agent and hire someone better.
Hmm. Yeah, look, she could have gotten the better role. It wasn't well written. Speaking of the writing of this film, this was made to be a response to the times of J.D. Vance being put up, and his memoir, as an explanation and understanding of Trump's America or areas that voted for Trump. But this is a film by design, and it's because of Howard. It's so politically neutered and empty. It's trying to be open to everyone. It's not trying to hit any buttons. But in the film and material that, by Vance's own statements, is heavily political, why is this just so reserved in every respect? And I'm not talking about moments where there's a Trump sign in the corner. I'm talking about getting at issues that have been raised by the 2016 and 2020 election. It doesn't, explicitly or otherwise.
Well, what is this movie really about, and what is it really saying? You know, it opens with this really dumb, on-the-nose voiceover of a sermon on the radio setting out the themes of the film and talking about the lost American
dream.
Never
a good sign.
Yeah, pretty bad sign. And then it's basically, okay, rich people are snobs, poor people are trying to do good, bad drugs will ruin your life. Like, it's just a bunch of status quo, boring messages playing to stereotypes.
Having said that, of the few good scenes in the film, I think the best one was the one involving deliberation over a drug test. There was a scene in the car between Glenn Close and the child. There was a sequence involving the Meals on Wheels, speaking to the poverty aspect. These were good
that was
scenes.
The Meals on Wheels scene was good. You're right. One scene that really spoke to me in the film, when J.D. Vance comes to see his mother after she's OD'd, and she says to him, you know, not to worry about her so much because I've actually been doing well. I've just had a down month. I thought that felt really real and spoke to the ways a lot of people process mental illness.
Yes, there were a lot of good scenes in that respect. An early scene, quite a confronting scene involving abuse that begins in a car, I think actually was handled reasonably
well. That was actually handled well. Yeah. There are moments. It's just that the film...
But...
Yeah.
Before that, I think we might have a placebo effect because of that, because so much of the film is so extremely loud. These moments also make an impact because these are not that loud in comparison. So they also stand out because these are not trying because they're already dramatically so strong.
The other scenes we were talking about are these quiet ones, but the car scene was quite loud and actually quite well executed. Like, I've always thought Ron Howard is not that good a director in terms of handling visuals and in terms of, you know, basic things like blocking and such. I've thought he's sort of quite mediocre or across the board, but he did
like Rush was good. He hasn't made a good film otherwise in a long time.
He pulled that scene off pretty well, though, a scene with a lot going on. So props to him for that, I guess.
There's another sequence of a car later between the grandmother and child, which again is handled quite well, except it can't, and it involves a few platitudes, but it is actually a good scene in and of itself. But it's preceded by so many platitudes, mostly coming from the Glenn Close character. It's very poorly written. There's all these buzz moments to try to get into marketing. As Chris and I were talking about last night, the Terminator line that's probably on the media.
The so Terminator bad. Line is just silly, just terribly written. There's a lot of terrible dialogue in this, terrible voiceovers, terrible musical score. The musical score is so intrusive and so... This is meant to be uplifted. Are you uplifted yet, guys? This is uplifting. Like, you know, that skippy, like, it's like if A Beautiful Mind were trying to be more energetic and
actually
inspirational.
A good movie. I will give some credit to A Beautiful Mind.
But yeah, the score is just, oh, God.
And I'm just going to note quickly the worst scene in the film, which is the scene where we see a bunch of kids doing kid things. And it's not how kids act. It's pretty sad coming from the guy who was in American Graffiti. But this is not a realistic portion of the trailer.
Also, Happy Days, right?
Yes, he was in Happy Days.
Yeah, he was an actual kid in Happy Days.
There's a lot of just unrealistic acting and poorly written little scenes all throughout the film. Also, how does a guy who's been at Yale Law School for more than a year not know how to use forks at a fine dining restaurant? Like, I feel like he would have gone to dinner somewhere fancy at some point in his life by then, even as a poor person.
Gilmore Girls established very clearly what it is like in the Yale dining hall. We've all seen it.
Yeah, exactly.
So that is Hillbilly Elegy. It is currently screening on Netflix. SFF are having their One Car Wide retrospective in January at the Art Gallery and at Dendy Cinemas Newtown. Happiest Season is in cinemas now. The Children's, Veterans, Japanese, and Antenna Film Festivals are all screening around Sydney and online now. Let us know what you want us to fight about. Stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. This has been Glenn Falcons and Chris Emmons of Rotten Eru. Check out Kino City. They've got a lot of great films.
Subscribe to us on Spotify, iTunes, Google Music, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And have a wonderful night and enjoy movies. Good night.
Bye.
Bye.